On the fifth day of the festival of Osiris, Pharaoh came downriver to Karnak from his palace on Elephantine Island, which was 10 days' travel away by swift river galley. He came in full state, with all his retinue, to officiate at the festival of the god. Tanos' squadron had left Karnak 3 days previously, speeding away upstream to meet the great flotilla and escort it on the last stage of the voyage, so neither Lostris nor I had seen him since we had all three returned from the great river cow hunt. It was a special joy for both of us then to see his galley come flying around the bend in the river, full on the current and with a strong desert wind abeam. The breath of Horus was in the van of the fleet, leading it up from the south. Lostris was in the Grand Vizier's train, standing behind her two brothers, Menset and Sobek. The two boys were comely and well-favoured, but there was too much of their father in them for my taste. Menset, the elder of the two, I particularly mistrusted, and the younger followed where his brother led. I was standing further back in the ruck of courtiers and lesser functionaries, from where I could keep an eye both on Lostris and on my lord Intef. I saw the back of her neck flush with pleasure and excitement at the glimpse she had of Tunnel's tall figure on the stern tower of the Breath of Horus. The scales on his crocodile skin breastplate gleamed in the sunlight, and the spray of ostrich feathers on his helmet floated in the draught of the galley's passage. Lostris was hopping with excitement and waving both slim arms above her head, but her squeals and her antics were lost in the roar of the vast crowd that lined both banks of the Nile to welcome their pharaoh. Thebes is the most populous city in the world, and I guess that almost 250,000 souls had turned out to welcome the king. Meanwhile, Tanos looked neither left nor right, but stared sternly ahead with his unsheathed sword held before his face in salute. The rest of his squadron followed the Breath of Horus in the wide V of the egret formation, named for the pattern that those birds fly in as they return in the sunset to their roosts. All their standards and battle honours were streaming out in a fluttering blaze of rainbow colours, a noble show that set the crowds cheering and waving their palm fronds wildly. It was some time before the first vessel of the main convoy came wallowing around the bend behind them. It was laden with ladies and nobles of the king's entourage. It was followed by another, and then by a great untidy horde of vessels, great and small. They came swarming downstream, transports filled with palace servants and slaves and all their accoutrements and paraphernalia, barges laden with oxen and goats and chickens for the kitchens, gilded and gaily painted vessels bearing cargoes of palace furniture and treasure, of nobles and lesser creatures, all uncomfortably jumbled together in a most unseamanlike fashion. In what contrast was the display put up by Tunnel's squadron as it rounded to downstream and held its geometrically spaced formation against the swift Nile current. At last, Pharaoh's state barge lumbered around the bend, and the cheering of the crowd rose to a crescendo. The huge vessel, the largest ever built by man, made its ponderous way towards where we were waiting to welcome it, at the stone wharf below the Grand Vizier's palace. I had plenty of time in which to study it and to muse how aptly its size and design and the handling of it reflected the present state and government of this very Egypt of ours. Egypt, as she stood in the 12th year of the rule of Pharaoh Mamosa, the 8th of that name and line, and the weakest yet of a weak and vacillating dynasty. The state barge was as long as 5 of the fighting galleys laid end to end, but its height and breadth were so ill-proportioned that they gravely offended my artistic instincts. Its massive hull was painted in the riotous colours that were the fashion of the age, and the figurehead of Osiris on the bows was gilded with real gold leaf. However, as she drew closer to the landing where we waited, I could see that the brilliant colours were faded in patches, and her sides were zebra-striped in dun where her crew had defecated over the rail. Amidships stood a tall deckhouse, Pharaoh's private quarters, that was so solidly constructed of thick planks of precious cedar and so stuffed with heavy furniture that the sailing characteristics of the barge were sadly affected. Atop this grotesque edifice, behind an ornate railing that was woven of fresh lilies, beneath a canopy of finely tanned gazelle skins skilfully sewn together and painted with images of all the major gods and goddesses, sat Pharaoh in majestic isolation. On his feet were sandals of gold filigree, and his robe was of linen so pure that it shone like the high cumulus clouds of full summer. On his head he wore the tall double crown, the white crown of Upper Egypt, with the head of the vulture goddess Nekbet, combined with the red crown and the cobra head of Buto, the goddess of the Delta. Despite the crown, the ironic truth was that this beloved sovereign of ours had lost the Delta almost 10 years previously. In our turbulent days, another pharaoh ruled in Lower Egypt, one who also wore the double crown, or at least his own version of it, a pretender who was our sovereign's deadly adversary, and whose constant wars against us drained both kingdoms of gold and the blood of the young men. Egypt was divided and torn by internal strife. Over the 1,000 or so years of our history, it had always been thus when weak men took on the mantle of Pharaoh. It needed a strong, bold, and clever man to hold the two kingdoms in his fists. In order to turn the unwieldy vessel into the current and bring her to her moorings at the palace wharf, the captain should have steered close in to the far bank. If he had done so, he would have had the full breadth of the Nile in which to complete his turn. However, he had obviously misjudged the strength of wind and current, and he began his turn from midstream. At first, the barge swung ponderously across the current, listing heavily as the height of the deckhouse caught the hot desert wind like a sail. Half a dozen bosuns raged about the lower deck with their whips rising and falling, the snapping of the lash on bare shoulders carrying clearly across the water. Under the goading of the lash, the rowers plied their paddles in a frenzy that churned the waters alongside the hull to foam, 100 paddles aside, pulling against each other, and none of them making any effort to synchronize the stroke. Their curses and cries blended with the shouted orders of the four helmsmen, who were struggling with the long steering oar in the stern. Meanwhile, on the poop deck, Nembet, the geriatric admiral and captain of the barge, alternately combed his fingers through his long, scraggy grey beard and flapped his hands in impotent agitation. High above this pandemonium sat Pharaoh, motionless as a statue and aloof from it all. Oh, verily, this was our Egypt. Then the rate of the barge's turn bled away until she was no longer swinging, but heading straight for where we stood on the bank, locked in chains by the pull of the current and the contrary push of the wind. Captain and crew, despite all their wild and erratic exertions, seemed powerless either to complete the manoeuvre and head her into the current, or to heave to and prevent her from ploughing headlong into the granite blocks of the wharf and staving in her great gilded bows. As everyone realized what was about to happen, the cheers of the crowd watching from the shore slowly died away, and an awful hush fell upon both banks of the Nile, into which the shouting and the turmoil on the decks of the huge vessel carried all the more clearly. Then suddenly, all the eyes of the crowd were drawn downstream, as the breath of Horus broke from her station at the head of the squadron and came tearing upriver, driven by the flying paddles. In perfect unison, those paddles dipped and pulled and swung and dipped again. She cut in so sharply under the bows of the barge that the crowd gasped with a sound higher than the wind in the papyrus beds. Collision seemed inevitable, but at the last possible moment, Tunnels signalled with a clenched fist lifted above his head. Simultaneously, both banks of rowers backed water, and the helmsman put the steering oar hard over. The breath of Horus checked and paid away before the ponderous advance of the great barge. The two vessels touched as lightly as a virgin's kiss, and for an instant the stern tower of the Breath of Horus was almost level with the barge's main deck. In that instant, Tunnels poised himself on the bulwark of the tower. He had kicked off his sandals, divested himself of his armour, and thrown aside his weapons. Around his waist he had tied the end of a light flax line. With the line trailing behind him, he leapt out across the gap between the two vessels. As though awakening from a stupor, the crowd stirred and shook itself. If there was still one amongst them who did not know who Tunnus was, he would know before this day was out. Of course, Tunnus' fame had already been won on the river, against the legions of the usurper in the Lower Kingdom. However, only his own troops had ever seen him in action. The reported deed never carries the same weight as the one that the eye sees for itself. Now, before the gaze of Pharaoh, the royal flotilla, and the entire populace of Karnak, Tunnels leapt from one deck to the other and landed as lightly as a leopard. "Tunnels, I am sure that it was my mistress Lostris who first called out his name, but I was next. Tanos! I yelled. And then all those around me took up the cry. Tanos! 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 They chanted it like an ode to some newly discovered god. The moment he landed on the deck of the barge, Tanos whirled and raced into the bows, hauling in the thin line hand over hand as he ran. The crew of his galley had spliced a heavy hawser, as thick as a man's arm, to the end of the carrying line. Now they sent it across as Tanos lay back against the weight of it. With the muscles of his arms and back shining with sweat, he dragged it in. By this time, a handful of the barge's crew had realized what he was about and rushed forward to help him. Under Tanos' direction, they took three turns with the end of the hawser about the barge's bowsprit, and the instant it was secured, Tanos signalled his galley away. The breath of Horus leapt into the current, gathering speed swiftly. Then abruptly she came up short against the hawser, and the weight of the heavy vessel on the other end threw her back on her haunches. For a dreadful moment I thought she might capsize and be dragged under, but Tanos had anticipated the shock and signalled his crew to cushion it by skilfully backing the long paddles. Although she was dragged down so low that she took in green water over her stern, the galley weathered it, bobbed up, and came back taut on the hawser. For a long moment nothing happened. The galley's puny weight made no impression on the great ship's ponderous way. The two vessels were locked together as though a crocodile had an old bull buffalo by the snout, but could not drag him from the bank. Then Tanos, in the bows of the barge, turned to face the disorganized crew. He made one authoritative gesture that caught all their attention, and a remarkable change came over them. They were waiting for his command. Nembet was the commander of all Pharaoh's fleet, with the rank of Great Lion of Egypt. Years ago he had been one of the mighty men, but now he was old and feeble. Tanos took over from him effortlessly, as though it were as natural as the force of the current and the wind, and the crew of the barge responded immediately. "Pull!" he gestured to the port bank of oarsmen, and they bent their backs and pulled with a will. "Backwater!" he stabbed his clenched fist at the starboard side, and they dug in hard with the pointed blades of their paddles. Tanos stepped to the rail and signalled to the helmsman of the Breath of Horus, masterfully coordinating the efforts of both crews. Still the barge was bearing down upon the wharf, and now only a narrow strip of open water separated the vessel from the granite blocks. Then at last, slowly, too slowly, she began to respond. The gaudily painted bows began to swing up into the current as the galley dragged them round. Once again the cheering died away, and that fateful hush fell upon us all as we waited for the enormous ship to crash into the wharf and tear out her own guts on the rock. When that happened, there was no doubt what the consequence must be for Tanos. He had snatched command from the senile admiral, and so must bear the full responsibility for all the old man's mistakes. When Pharaoh was dashed from his throne by the collision, when the double crown and all his dignity were sent rolling across the deck, and when the state barge sank beneath him, and he was dragged from the river like a drowning puppy before the gaze of all his subjects, then there would be both the insulted Admiral Nembet and my Lord Intef to encourage Pharaoh to bring the full weight of his displeasure to bear upon the presumptuous young upstart. I stood helplessly and trembled for my dear friend. And then a miracle occurred. The barge was already so close to running aground, and Tanos so near to where I stood, that his voice carried clearly to me. "Great Horus, help me now!" he cried. There is no doubt at all in my mind that the gods often take a hand in the affairs of men. Tanos is a Horus man, and Horus is the god of the wind. The desert wind had blown for 3 days and nights out of the western desolation of the Sahara. It had blown at the strength of half a gale, without a check for all that time. But now it dropped. It did not taper off, it simply ceased to blow at all. The wavelets that had flecked the surface of the river flattened out, and the palms along the waterfront that had been vigorously shaking their fronds fell still, as though frozen by a sudden frost.